Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. I'm still on location in Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia, to be precise, at the Virginia Commonwealth University. And so today I'm going to be talking to Professor Nick Farrell. He's in the Department of Chemistry at VCU and has got certain fame because if I was to ask you randomly out there, what do you know about something called cisplatin? I think majority of you would say, oh, isn't that some form of cancer drug? And indeed, you'd be absolutely right. It's a very effective and also very expensive drug. Nick, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm sure it is, right in your own hometown, in your home garden.
Indeed.
Before we get into cisplatin, transplatin, cancer, chemotherapy, drug-related materials of that type, let's talk about Nick Farrell. How on earth did you become a scientist? What was it when you were a kid? And where were you a kid?
I was a kid in Dublin, in Ireland, and I guess I just had a good affinity for science in school. I enjoyed the chemistry very much, and I remember the story. I was at a Christian Brothers school, so I had a teacher who called me by my first name, which was unheard of, because most people were always called by their last name, but we were in chemistry class, and I answered some questions, and he wanted to encourage me to answer more questions, and I was afraid of being seen as the nerd, and I wasn't particularly
the teacher's pet.
Yes,
a tough
thing
to be.
I stopped, and he said, "No, come on, Nicholas." And that was unheard of at the time. So anyway, so I developed an affinity for science, and when I went to college, I was interested in languages, but I felt that you could always do language. I couldn't see what sort of career you would have in languages, and so I felt I would like to pursue a science career, a science research degree. And so that's what I did, and I managed to continue doing that, and it's something I've enjoyed all my life. And
where did you go to school? Where did you go to university?
I went to University College Dublin for my first degree, and then I went to Sussex University for my PhD.
Okay, and then what did you do? Well, let me back off a minute. One of the strengths of VCU, as I'm beginning to understand it, and it's not alone in universities, is the fact they like to get undergraduates into a research environment, if possible.
Yes.
Now, I would hazard a guess that was nothing you did like that in Dublin.
We did, actually. In University College Dublin, we had a research experience for undergraduates. I did it in a physical chemistry lab, actually, at the time. But we did actually have a semester for our final year.
Oh, yeah, well, precisely. One term in the last year, but not an ongoing process.
No, not an ongoing process.
So it was sort of dipping your toe in the water,
yes,
but not really getting wet.
That's probably right. Correct.
So what did you do when you got to Sussex, that famous university down in southeast of England?
Well, I worked on platinum chemistry at the time. This was now the early 70s. And so there was the first of many petrol crises, and organometallic chemistry, as you well know, was very popular and hot, and the concept was to take molecules, coordination compounds, organometallic compounds, and use them as catalysts and possibly develop feedstocks which would be independent of petrochemicals. Not quite there yet, but that was the main purpose, the main interest in Sussex at the time. Colin Eborn started the Department of Chemistry. Sussex, as you know, was a red brick university, a young university, and it was a very perceptive idea of his that organometallic chemistry was going to be a new wave of chemistry in the 60s, and so he hired.
And that coincides with all the new journals in the area, too.
That's correct.
So it's a good time to be in the game.
Yes, it was, absolutely. And Sussex was a very exciting place because, as I say, it was a young place, and so the faculty were young, and we played football together and squash together, and I think it was a great environment to learn.
What did you think you wanted to do with this science background? Because if you're anything like I was, you really didn't know, except you didn't want to move out of a university environment, which is probably not very healthy.
Well, I will tell you, yes, I will tell you a story about that. I went to Sussex for my PhD, and I came back, and my father said to me, he was very proud of me, and he said, well, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I'm going to do a postdoctoral fellowship. And he said, what's that? And I explained, it was research. And he said, I thought that's why you went to Sussex. I said, well, it's different, it's more independent. And he looked at me and said, you be careful, son. You might get a job someday.
Right. So, all fathers tend to say the same
yes,
thing.
I've mentioned that to a number of my students whose fathers have said pretty similar things to them over the years, actually. That's correct.
And in the end, I mean, obviously you never had what your father would have thought of as a real job. You've always been associated with academic institutions.
It took him a while, I think, and like it takes most fathers and brothers to realize that this endeavor can pay a mortgage and bring up kids and so forth. Yeah, it took him a while to realize that.
I remember that I went through this same business, and I think one of the ameliorating facts was that I could send postcards from all different places in the world
yes.
that I was going to, which he had never been to, because he had a real job. He was an accountant, and that was, mm-hmm. You just mm-hmm. stayed in London. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had holidays, but not on a regular basis like we do. So anyway, you did a postdoc. Where did you go?
I went to Canada. I went first to Simon Fraser University and then on to University of British Columbia.
All right.
And at that time, the next wave of inorganic chemistry was bioinorganic chemistry was becoming more and more popular, and more and more people were examining what's exactly the chemistry of metal ions and biological systems. And so that caught my fancy. And so I did postdoctoral fellowships basically in the broad area of what you would call now bioinorganic chemistry.
Yeah, and I mean, just for the casual listener out there, if there are any casual listeners, bio in front of anything seems to be, the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, everybody's worried about being healthier, living longer, living better quality of life. And so bioengineering is a whole field that wasn't there 25 years ago.
True.
So let's get onto this business of, well, first of all, tell the audience when I mentioned at the beginning, cisplatinum, mm-hmm. or cisplatin as it's sort of called. Tell the audience, what is this? What does it do? Why is it useful?
Well, it's very useful because it is a very small molecule which is used as a mainstay for cancer treatment. Most cancer treatments will be combination chemotherapies. Cisplatin is used in most powerful combinations, and there are now three variations approved by the FDA for use in the United States. There's maybe five or six worldwide. They're all based on the same structure, which we'll get to in a moment, but they're all based on the same structure. And over 50% of patients, we would estimate that over 50% of patients would receive a platinum during their course of treatment. So it's combined with immunotherapy, it's combined with targeted drugs, it's a very, very effective agent.
Let's sort of explain a little bit more, because when you put it in those sort of crude terms, that here's a platinum complex, and platinum is not your everyday element.
No.
There's never been discovered anywhere in the world a living species which has got any platinum associated with it. So it's a totally alien element, and all of a sudden it's one of the first treatments of a disease like cancer. What is it that the platinum has got that is so unique compared to all these other more organic, like Taxol and things like that, which we also hear are useful pharmaceuticals for treating cancer? What's the secret?
Well, the other part about platinum is actually, I believe, is kinetic reactions, and that is that the rates of substitution reactions, the rates of the chemistry reactions that occur, are on the same scale as a biological reaction. They take a few hours or a few days. And that's what you need as a drug gets distributed through the body and into cells. You don't want something that reacts too fast, because then it'll decompose in blood. You don't want something that reacts too slow, because it'll be eliminated. And so in some ways, it's a fortuitous circumstance that the kinetics of platinum, the rates of substitution reactions, are about the same as you would want in a body for distribution and metabolism.
So we've got the size and therefore the diffusibility, and mm-hmm. then it can get around the body wherever mm-hmm. it's almost needed. And somehow it can distinguish a cancer cell from a healthy cell.
Yes.
Not particularly well.
No.
Because that's why there's so much serious side effects, and why in 25 years, people will look back on this period as being rather medieval, I think, in the treatment of cancers. But I may be wrong, and you can correct us as we go along. But how does it distinguish between a healthy and a cancerous cell?
Well, in broad terms, we would say that the cancer cell has a more difficult time to deal with the effects of cisplatin. And that may seem counterintuitive, but if you consider that the cancer cell is a cell that's gone wrong in the first place, it doesn't have great DNA repair capability because it's already mutated. There's really something wrong with it. So even though it's a cancer cell, it's still what we would say is an insult to the body. It's a toxic substance. It's a foreign substance. You're quite right. There's no enzymes that have platinum in it. And so in very broad terms, the differential effect is that the normal cell may be able to repair the damage of platinum more efficiently than that of the tumor cell.
I see. So that explains to everybody, me included, that why, in fact, all cells are very susceptible to being killed by these treatments, and that's why, therefore, you've got a very limited time period for treatment. You can't have a treatment, a platinum treatment for your whole life. I could take aspirins every day for the rest of my life.
Exactly.
But platinum is usually for a short, focused time period.
That's correct, and the regimens will be doses over a period of time, and then the patient may recover, may come back a few months later and get a second dose of treatment, but it's not something that you could take daily. That's not.
And so there's no prophylactic aspect to this. It's just purely you're going to cure it, and it's going to hopefully do extend a life period. Right now, what is the sort of expectancy? Once someone has been diagnosed with a cancer and treated with platinum, there are different types of cancer, bowel cancer, breast cancer, you name it. What are the particular type of cancers that the platinum drugs, this family, is particularly useful for?
Well, the advent of platinum or cisplatinum into the cancer clinic, we would say, has rendered testicular cancer curable. So you're quite right. One of the things we did learn from our war on cancer, started by Richard Nixon, of all people, is that cancer is 100 diseases, it's not one disease. And each tissue has a different properties. But in the case of testicular cancer, with surgery and possible early treatment, we would consider that cancer is now, testicular cancer is now a curable disease, just with platinum. So the advent of one drug into the clinic has rendered one cancer curable.
Okay.
It was sensitive perhaps beforehand, now it's curable. So it's a remarkable result, and it has saved many thousands of lives.
Do people understand what is so special about the testicular cancer cell compared to a breast cancer cell or whatever?
Still not quite. That's still harder. There are some theories, but there's nothing definitive about that. People are working on that because obviously if we can figure that out, then we can figure out other cell types that might be similar, or tumor types that might be similar that could be treated, but that's not quite clear.
I guess we should have done this at the beginning of the program, but I've got to ask you to go through the history of the discovery of cisplatin, because that's a beautiful story.
It's
totally serendipitous.
It's a fantastic story. You can't, quite right, you took the words out of my mouth, you can't talk about the story without using the word serendipity, but also a very important lesson for stubbornness and determination, and also a mind-changing idea, just that bolt of lightning. So the story is that a biophysicist called Barney Rosenberg was studying E. coli, a living bacterium, and he was studying the effect of an electric field on the growth of bacteria. And there is an effect in bacteria called filamentous growth, where the bacteria multiply but they don't divide. So if you think of bacterium as very, very small, you can normally see it not. You cannot see it under a light microscope. You have to use larger magnitude to see these very tiny cells. In the case of filamentous growth, it grows to many times its size. And you can actually see that under a light microscope. So he observed that effect with an electric field, and after considerable detective work, realized that it wasn't the electric field that did it. It was actually a very small amount of platinum which was dissolved into the medium containing the bacteria.
From the electrode.
Now you'd use a platinum electrode because it's inert.
That's exactly.
That's why you use it. And it took about a number of years to figure that out. Barney was a biophysicist, wasn't a chemist, and went over to his chemistry department in Michigan State at the time, and somebody coming through suggested that, like you're coming through here in Richmond, suggested that it might be a compound. They went to the chemistry department. They asked them to make a platinum compound with ammonia and chlorine. They did. It didn't work. And so they were flummoxed. And then somebody else came through and said, well, you know, there are two isomers of platinum. There's the trans and the cis, as you've discussed. And the chemists had first made the trans isomer. So they went back and they made the cis isomer. They tried the cis isomer without an electric field, and it worked. So now you had an effect. You had an effect on bacteria. That's all you had. You had filamentous growth on bacteria. But Rosenberg reasoned that since it's the cells are multiplying but not dividing, it had something to do with DNA. And at that time, DNA was considered a very popular target for anti-cancer drugs, not so much these days, but genomics and proteomics. And so he reasoned that if it had an effect on dividing cells by DNA in bacteria, maybe it would have a similar effect on dividing cells in cancer. And that turned out to be correct.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah, it is a wonderful story.
Did Rosenberg get much recognition for this? I mean, I know the name, because I'm a chemist. But in the broader circle of pharmaceutical industry and recognition?
Probably not as much as he deserves.
Okay.
Because the other part of the story is that he got the data and showed it was wonderfully widely effective in various tumor types, but no pharmaceutical company was interested because they said, it's a heavy metal. What are you crazy?
And heavy metals, as the audience know, it's got a terrible connotation. We've got to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm here at the university. No, I'm not. I'm here at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, talking to Professor Nick Farrell, bio and organic chemist working with platinum. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, Professor Nick Farrell from Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And we're talking about the discovery of the platinum drugs that are so ubiquitous around the world for treating a whole range of cancers, and how we just learned that testicular cancer is a thing of the past. Or put it another way, if you catch it or get it, should I say, you can be cured. Tell us a little bit about this little game that you've been playing, which is also sort of counterintuitive. At the beginning, trans isomer, the two groups on the diagonals of a square, non-reactive. If they're on the same side of a square, reactive. But you therefore decided we must investigate the transform more. What do you know?
Yeah, well, the what we call the structure activity relationships were laid down originally, and most of the early compounds that were active were cis, and so that was considered to be necessary for anti-tumor activity. But one of the problems, as probably most drugs, is that patients do develop resistance to cisplatin, as you might develop resistance to penicillin or something like that. And so we reasoned that we should examine other structures. As a chemist, how many structures can you think of with platinum in them?
Two, cis or trans.
And many others. So there are thousands of possibilities.
Well, there are thousands of different substituents.
Right.
Two geometries
in general. But we decided that the trans platinum, coming back to my earlier point about the pharmacokinetics, the trans platinum is more reactive than the cis platinum. And so we thought, well, if we use different substituents to slow the chemistry of trans platinum down, can we make it start to look like cisplatin by using different substituents? And secondly, the other aspect that we looked at is we knew we were beginning to find out how cisplatin affected DNA and what proteins recognize the damage and so on and so forth. And this was a component of resistance. And so we reasoned that if we were to make a different geometry, like a trans geometry, the conformational changes we would have on DNA were going to be different from cisplatin, and therefore those changes might circumvent the resistance. And that's actually what happened. We achieved both of our goals. We made compounds which were equally as effective in tissue culture as cisplatin.
Equally effective?
Yes, in tissue culture as cisplatin.
Right.
But they were actually active in what we call cisplatin-resistant lines. So then you would have the possibility of complementarity, so that you could to a patient who develops resistance for cisplatinum, you might be able to give them eventually a transplatinum drug or a polynuclear drug. We also
or just a combination of the two acting by different routes.
Exactly. And they would attack slightly different aspects, and so you would maybe get a more effective combination that way. So that's what we did, and that's what we've been working on.
And where is the future? I mean, it's okay working on tissue culture, but have you then got permission to use mammals, and then sooner or later?
Along the lines of, so basically what we've been doing then is challenging, as chemists, challenging the structure-activity relationships. Why is it that people just think one geometry is active and nothing else? So that seemed counterintuitive to me, actually. Not easy to convince funding agencies to fund this when the structure-activity relationships were laid down. But we were lucky enough to find some very effective compounds. We went through the next steps. The next steps after in tissue culture in the laboratory would be to do animal models, and then if they were good, you would then look at toxicity, and if that toxicity was good and you had some interest from a pharmaceutical company, you could go into clinical trials.
But let's go back a moment. You're talking about tissue culture of cancer cells.
Yes. Yeah.
What about healthy cells? Is this stuff equally toxic towards healthy cells?
No, there's a differential.
Well, I shouldn't have said equally, but the difference between the cis with healthy and cancer cells is the same as trans with healthy and cancer cells.
Yeah.
There's no advantage from the
specificity. There's no advantage of specificity because they're still non-specific in that sense. They're still cytotoxic.
All right. Mm-hmm. So what's the future then in this game?
Well, I think the future will be to develop new platinum drugs that will get to the clinic. As I said, we got as far as phase 2 clinical trials, which is a rare event for an academic chemist in the first place. You consider that only 1 in 10,000 compounds, even less, on a chemist bench actually ever gets administered to humans. And even then, the rate of
at
success...
At least deliberately.
Yes, indeed. At least deliberately, and the rate of success from a drug entering phase 1 clinical trials to being fully approved is still only about 16% overall. It's not a high success rate. So I think in platinum, the goal would be to now look at all we know in the progress over the last 30, 40 years. Of course, we know much more about cancer biology. We know much more about the mechanism of cisplatin, so we can be much more smarter in terms of designing compounds that will overcome very specific aspects such as cisplatin resistance. And that will be the future, that we will develop a drug that's complementary to cisplatin that can be used when
That's a very sort of a positive approach that obviously somebody working in the field is bound to have, right?
One would need to have that.
Absolutely. It comes with the territory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But going back to my rather brash statement at the beginning that in 20 years or so we'll look back on this period, rather that we look back now on a period of the 60s and 70s and the 80s where we were treating all sorts of, well, children with rheumatic diseases with osmium compounds and tin compounds, and they all turned out to be in the long run a total disaster. Now, the platinum drugs have not been a total disaster, but it's a sledgehammer for a rather delicate disease. Do you think that we're going with the tweaking to the immune system that is going on now for more natural bio drugs to be much more the answer to this problem?
I think overall you would have to say that the vast majority of opinion is that the biologics, as you say, is the answer. But at the same time, even they work best with small drugs like platinum. So I would say
right?
Yes, that's true. So I would say that in
well,
20...
Hang on a moment. Explain that. What's the symbiosis?
It's not quite clear yet, but in the clinic some of these PARP inhibitors are doing very well. In the case of cisplatin, I would say that the immunotherapy is being tested with platinums, and possibly, again, the symbiosis is that you're approaching the cancer cell with two very different methods, two very different approaches.
Yeah, they can't fight two battles at the same time.
Again, coming back to the point that reminding your audience that they've lost the first battle in the first place by becoming a cancer cell rather than a normal cell.
Right.
So I would say that my prognosis, being a glasses half full type of guy, is that in 20, 25 years we'll have a library of smart platinums which we've developed and by learning about cisplatinum and learning its combination at the moment and go that way. That's what I would suggest that we should look at. So in other words, with respect to the immunotherapy and these targeted approaches and platinum drugs, the people involved in platinum chemistry and platinum biology, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is still room for development of smart drugs.
We've only got a few minutes left, but I want to go back to why platinum. I mean, there's a host of interesting metals which have geometries which would seem quite capable of intercalating into a DNA. Mm. And I'm sure by now people have tried almost every one of them. Ruthenium, nickel, even titanium. Is there anything there on the horizon that you know that perhaps you could tell the audience, well, keep your eye open for, samarium. Just to choose
one. Well, the family of compounds that are probably closest, because they're similar in chemistry to platinum, there are some ruthenium compounds. There have been some gold compounds and some osmium compounds, actually by different mechanisms, which, again, you mentioned osmium earlier on. Osmium tetroxide would have been considered even more Neanderthal than the sledgehammer. This is,
right.
However, there are some very interesting osmium compounds that do very specific things in mitochondria, ruthenium compounds which are anti-metastatic rather than cytotoxic. So these are things which have been tested, and people are beginning to do clinical trials, or trying to do clinical trials with some of those compounds.
Okay. Well, one last question. This is very technical, as if the rest of it hasn't been reasonably technical. But is the capacity of platinum to exist in two geometric forms, not cis and trans with a planar, but four-coordinate planar, the so-called square planar, and then octahedral with two up and down, does that play a role in the utility of platinum?
Yes, absolutely.
As a drug?
Yeah, the square planar geometry is essential for the mechanism of action on cisplatin. It basically, because it's a square plane, and because you're substituting the two red dots, as you said, to bind with DNA, that produces the change in DNA, the distortion in DNA that eventually leads to...
So the other two apical positions above and below the plane are not involved in the biological activity?
No, they would be platinum. They would be different oxidation states. They would be
platinum. It could be, but I mean...
Yeah, but they they're not involved. No,
okay.
They're not involved.
I just wanted to clear that up for personal reasons, and I beg indulgence from the audience. We've come to the end of a very quick 28 minutes with Professor Nicholas Farrell from Virginia Commonwealth University, talking about his successful foray, well-recognized foray, into the area of trans-platinum compounds. And not many people did it, not many people do it, but there's some very important and interesting results that have come out. So, Nick, thanks very much for being here on Science Studio.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you.